Existing before the creation, when there was nothing but myself, nor was there the material nature, the cause of this creation. That which you see now is also I, the personality of Godhead. And after annihilation, what remains will also be I, the personality of Godhead. Purport. We should note very carefully that the personality of Godhead is addressing Lord Brahma and specifying with great emphasis himself, pointing out that it is He, the personality of Godhead, who existed before the creation. It is He only who maintains the creation, and it is He who remains after the annihilation of the creation. Brahma is also a creation of the Supreme Lord. The impersonalist puts forth the theory of oneness in the sense that Brahma, also being the same principle of I, because He is an emanation from the I, the absolute truth, is identical with the Lord, the principle of I, and that there is nothing more than the principle of I as explained in this verse. According to the argument of the impersonalists, it is to be admitted that the Lord is the creator I and that the Brahma is the created I. Therefore, is that there is a difference between the two I's, namely the predominator I and the predominated I. Therefore, there are still two I's, even accepting the argument of the impersonalists. But we must note carefully that these two I's are accepted in the Vedic literature, Kathopanishad, in the sense of quality. The Kathopanishad says, Nityo Nityanam Chetanaschetananam Eko Bahunam Yo Vidadhati Kaman. The creator I and the created I are both accepted in the Vedic Vedas as qualitatively one because both of them are Nityas and Chetanas. But the singular I is the creator I, and the created I are of plural number because there are many I's like Brahma and those generated by Brahma. It is the simple truth. The father creates or begets a son, and the son also creates many sons, and all of them may be one as human beings, but at the same time, from the father, the son and the grandson are all different. The son cannot take the place of the father, nor can the grandsons. Simultaneously, the father, the son and the grandson are one and different also. As human beings, they are one, but as relatives, they are different. Therefore, the relativities of the creator and the created, or the predominator and the predominated, have been differentiated in the Vedas by saying that the predominator I is the feeder of the predominated I's. And thus, there is a vast difference between the two principles of I. This is a very long purport, so we'll focus on this section in today's class. Om Ajnanatimirandasya Jnananjanashalakaya Chakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Panchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. So I'm honored to be back here amidst all of you. And last year, all of you tolerated me very kindly. I tried to speak something on the Lord's glories. I'm grateful to have the opportunity again this year. So today and the next 3 days, I'll be taking a series on the Chaturshloki Bhagavat. So instead of the regular verses, we are having these 4 verses. So this is the first of the Chaturshloki Bhagavat. I'll take this class, today's class, in 3 parts. First, I'll explain the concept of Chaturshloki as it is found in the Bhakti tradition. Then I'll talk about the context of the Chaturshloki within the Bhagavatam, and then we'll focus on this particular verse. The Vedic literature are vast. The Bhagavad Gita is 700 verses, but the Bhagavatam is thousands of verses. And the Vedas themselves, Jiva Goswami explains in the Bhagavad Sandarbha, that many of the ancient Vedas are no longer available. So because the Vedas were such a vast body of knowledge, even in the Vedic times, the Acharyas time and time again tried to condense the essence of scriptures in certain sentences, in certain statements. Just like we may have, if we have a big book, sometimes people are told to write a précis of the book, an abstract of the book. The idea is that people can easily understand the essence of that subject by studying the shortened version, and then they can later study the expanded version. So, Ramanujacharya talked about Chatushloki of the Bhagavad Gita, that is 10.8 to 11. And this is just before Arjuna says that now I have accepted you as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the Chatushloki is not just a Chatushloki or any summary of the book, is both in terms of the content and the context. The content is what do these three or four or whatever verses are there, what do they say? And the context is where are they placed? So the Bhagavad Gita, when we look at the Chatushloki over there, 10.8 to 11, there we see immediately after that, Arjuna says that I accept you as the absolute truth. Now I accept everything that you say, that you are the Supreme. Not only are you saying it, but others are also saying it. Param Brahma Param Dhamma Pavitram Paramam Bhavan Purushim Shashvatam Divyam. And so before this, Krishna at the start of the 10th chapter has stated that now I am going to speak to you the most confidential knowledge again. Param Bhuya Pravakshami. So Bhuya Eva Mahabaho Shrunume Paramam Vacha Yatteham Priyamanaya Vakshami Hitakamyaya. So Krishna himself says that I am going to speak the most confidential knowledge. And Arjuna says, now I am enlightened. So from the context we can understand what was spoken in between is very important. And those four verses, they talk, Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharya has explained, that they talk about Sambandha, Abhideya and Prayojan. That's how they can encapsulate the essence of the message of the Bhagavad Gita. So similarly, let's look at the Bhagavatam's Chatushloki. What is the context? The Bhagavatam has various narratives or conversations going on at different levels. So the outermost conversation is between the sages of Naimisharanya and Sutta Goswami. Then the second conversation, which is what the Bhagavatam is more defined for, more well known for, that is between Parikshit Maharaj and Shukadeva Goswami, which starts from the first verse of the second canto. Towards the last few verses of the 19th chapter of the first canto, we have Parikshit Maharaj asking the question. Shukadeva Goswami appears, but Shukadeva Goswami doesn't speak in the first canto. His speech starts in the second canto. And in the second canto, we have multiple things happening. And actually, by the sixth chapter of the second canto, whatever question specifically Parikshit Maharaj has asked about what is the duty of a person about to die, so Shukadeva Goswami has answered in summary. And at that time, Parikshit Maharaj asks another set of questions. And then the whole Bhagavatam starts off in earnest. So here, the Bhagavatam is transcendental, at the same time it is chronological. Chronological in the sense that, especially from the second canto onwards, from this point onwards, practically the ninth chapter onwards, the Bhagavatam can be read as the narration of events within one day of Brahma. So within, we could say, that particular Brahma's day and Brahma's life, the beginning is brought over here. And from the beginning onwards, then we start from the second canto, the subsequent creations of various other Rudra and Kumaras and the sages, that goes on. And after that, then primarily the Manus. What happens during the various Manus that is described. So from the third canto onwards to the seventh canto end is described what happens in the life of Swayambhu Manu. And then afterwards, in a quick overview, from the first Manu to seventh Manu is described. And then eighth canto onwards to the twelfth canto, what happens in the life of Vaivasvat Manu, that is the present Manu, that is described. So the Bhagavatam in that sense, we could say, is like a biography of the universe. A biography of the universe. Normally we talk about biography of a person, people. But we could have biography of things also. Okay, where was this? How, what did happen? How, where did it go? Who all used this thing? So we could say roughly the Bhagavatam is a biography of the universe. But it's not exactly telling just what all happened at what time in the universe. It is a transcendental biography where within the history of the universe, what all are the events of transcendental significance, they are described.
Now, within the Bhagavatam's narrative, the start here is that Brahmaji, after he was created, he was in darkness, both literally and metaphysically. Physically, there was darkness all around, and metaphysically, he did not know. Who am I? What am I? Where am I? What am I to do? So at that time he performed tapasya, and by the performance of austerities, he got enlightenment. Actually, he performed austerity. He was surrendered to the Lord, then he got an instruction to perform austerities. When he performed the austerities, then the Lord appeared in front of him. When the Lord appears in front of him, Brahmaji offers prayers. And in the midst of offering those prayers, the Lord becomes very pleased with Brahmaji's austerity, his prayerful attitude. And the Lord comes forward and shakes hands with Brahmaji. So, shaking hands is a way in which intimacy or affection is expressed. And then prior to this, this is the 33rd verse, roughly from 25th to 29th, 30th verses, Brahmaji asks some questions. Actually, his prayer is going on for a long time. But towards the conclusion of that, he asks some questions. So he asks, "My dear Lord, you are transcendental. How do you manifest in a form that is visible to my eyes? My dear Lord, you are transcendental, and how do you manifest all the various energies by which creation takes place? My dear Lord, how can I act in a way in this material world by which I can be an instrument for your will? And yes, my dear Lord, how can I, while acting in this world, for your service, avoid becoming proud?" And then the Lord starts answering his questions. So now, actually the Lord's answer comes in 7 verses. So Vallabhacharya refers to it as the Sapta Shloki, rather than the Chatushloki Bhagavata. He says the essence of the Bhagavatam, he says it comes in 7 verses. But in our tradition, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he talks about it as Chaturshloki. And before that also, Jiva Goswami in his Bhagavad Sandarbha focuses on Chaturshloki. Because the earlier 3 verses before this are more or less building the narrative. They are not so much filled with philosophical import as these 4 verses are. So, this is the background. So, this means, in one sense, Brahmaji's life journey is meant to mirror our life journey. Brahmaji is born in darkness and then he becomes enlightened. And then after being enlightened, he acts as an instrument for the Lord's will. Similarly, all of us are also born in darkness, in ignorance. And we too are meant to become enlightened. And after becoming enlightened, we too are meant to act as instruments for the Lord's will. Nimitta matram bhava sauve sachi. Krishna tells Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita in 11.33. Nimitta matram. Just become an instrument. And it's interesting, right in that verse, where Krishna is telling Arjuna that you should become an instrument. Sometimes, now the word instrument might seem somewhat depersonalizing. And if you say, this is an instrument I am using. That means if you say something is an instrument, that means that does not have consciousness, that does not have intelligence, that does not have its ability. It's just working for somebody else. So, the bhakti philosophy is eminently a personal philosophy. Then why do we say nimitta matram? The word nimitta, actually, if we see, Krishna complements that with sauvyasachi. There are many names of Krishna, of Arjuna, which Krishna uses in the Bhagavad Gita. But this particular name, he uses only once. And sauvyasachi means that one who is ambidextrous, one who is equally well versed in shooting arrows with both hands. Actually, that is not an ordinary ability. Like even now, we may not be shooting arrows, but most of us do handwriting. Now, you know, very few people are actually equally good at handwriting with both ways, both hands. So we can write well with one hand, but write equally well with the second hand, that is not so easy. So Arjuna, Krishna, while telling Arjuna to become an instrument for his sake, acknowledges Arjuna's abilities. So some people have this idea that human will and divine will are at war with each other. So if we surrender to the divine will, then we lose our individuality, we lose our freedom. The truth, however, is that human will is founded and fulfilled in the divine will. Human will is founded in the divine will. Now, Krishna could have created this world in whatever way he had wanted. Now, if he had wanted us to be just insentient instruments, then he could very well have made all of us as insentient instruments. But Krishna wants the reciprocation of love. So he has made us as conscious beings with free will. And so human will is founded in divine will. It is by God's grace that we have free will. And human will is fulfilled in the divine will. What does that mean? That means that when there is a loving relationship between two people, at that time, it is the pleasure of the lover to do the will of the beloved. When we love someone, naturally we want to please that person. And to please that person means we willingly and happily do what that person wants. Now sometimes when there is a loving relationship or affectionate relationship between two people, say one person might be exploitative, and doing that person's will may cause harm to other people. So for example, say somebody is like an autocrat. So when in the Second World War, say after under Hitler's rule, many of the Nazis killed millions and millions of people. So after that, there were the Nuremberg trials. And many of the Nazi journals at that time said that we are not responsible because we are simply carrying out the orders. So now in this case, the plaintiff, those who had arrayed them for accusation, they said that you have to use your human intelligence, your human conscience. How could you have killed people in cold blood and justified saying that we're just following orders? So the problem is that in this world, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So that's why when there is a thought of surrender to some authority, people have apprehension that if we surrender, then we may be exploited. We may be made puppets for doing harm to us as well as to others. But Krishna is utterly different from such worldly people who misuse their power. So Krishna is omnibenevolent. He is the well-wisher of all living beings. And to do his will is the best thing that we can do. When we love him and when we strive to do his will, become an instrument for him, we actually bring out the best in ourselves. So spirituality is not about giving up our individuality. It is about realizing our individuality. Now we just like sometimes, some people say just be yourself. Yes, be yourself, but be your higher self, not your lower self. That means, say in any field, if somebody wants to play music, so if you tell that person be yourself, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that you just say pick up a kartal and just play it whatever way you want. This is yourself. This will not be yourself. This will be actually your worst self. So, say if a person wants to be a musician, yes, a musician has one's own individual way of playing music. All distinctive famous musicians, they have their individual style. But what appears as spontaneous and natural style doesn't come spontaneously and naturally. It requires days, weeks, months, years of practice. So, to be yourself means to be actually our better self, not our worse self. And that requires practice. And even in the musical sense, there are some musical teachers also, they use the word purification. What does that mean? You know, the dissonant sounds that are coming, the inappropriate ways in which you are expressing yourself, they get cleansed by practice. And then the pure music, pure in the musical sense, that is, it's resonant, it's consonant, it's not dissonant, that comes out. So something similar applies in our case also. Human will is fulfilled in the divine will. That means when we practice devotional service to Krishna steadily, by that our essential pure personality starts manifesting. And then we become the best that we can be. So Krishna, surrendering to Krishna is not about giving up our free will, it is about perfecting our free will. So here, when Krishna tells Brahmaji that you become an instrument of my will, Brahma is asking, how can I do this well? So how can I act as your instrument properly? Now this itself includes, this question itself includes the understanding that when we act as an instrument for someone, our free will is not lost. Because one can be an imperfect instrument, one can be a perfect instrument. That means we have to use our free will properly so that we can become a proper instrument for the Lord. In becoming an instrument for the Lord, we become truly we. Now sometimes, you know, if we get angry and then we speak some things, and suppose, you know, whoever we are shouting that, that person has just kept a recording device on. Maybe this mobile is on. And then after we blast everything out, and after 3-4 days and we are cooled down, that person brings that same recorded device and shows us, did I speak this? You know, our anarthas can make us strangers to ourselves. Lust, anger, greed, envy, they can make us strangers to ourselves. You know, sometimes some people get so angry and they behave such a way, I don't know you. You know, who are you? What kind of, how are you behaving like this? I never thought you would speak like this. So we may say this to others when others behave improperly, others behave shockingly, but actually if we were to observe our own behavior, we will also sometimes behave in ways that are shocking. So this is not the real we. This is not the real I. For the bringing out the real I, there needs to be purification. So I was making the point that our life story, in a broad sense, is or should be a mirror of Brahmaji's life story. And in the first verse when Krishna speaks over here, Lord speaks over here, he is explaining his position. So Brahmaji's question was, my dear Lord, you are transcendental. How do you manifest in a form in this world, which we can access, which we can perceive? So to answer that question, Brahmaji, the Lord first focuses on a philosophical understanding of his position. So here he says, he talks about himself in relationship with time. He says, aham evasam eva agre na anyat yat sat satparam. So he says that it was I alone who existed in the beginning, it is I alone who exists now, and it is I alone who will exist in the future. Now, there are atheists who try to say that there is an evolution of people's conception of God. So they say when people were very primitive, they believed in many gods. They were polytheists. Then after that, when people became a little more intellectually evolved, they became monotheists. Believe there is only God. There is only one God. And then they say as people will evolve further, they will become atheists. There is no God. So, so they have this idea from many gods to one God to no God. Now, Mayavadis take it around, impersonalists rather, they take it around and they say, yes, there is evolution, but there is another kind of evolution. See, that people believed in many gods earlier, then they believe only in one God, and then they will understand there is only God. That means, there is no one except God. So, sometimes people have some provocative slogans they put on their t-shirts. So, in India, some people, they put, I was an atheist, till I discovered I was God. So, this idea that I am God is very titillating for the false ego of the conditioned soul. At the same time, there is, in the broad Vedantic understanding, the Vedas are a very broad body of knowledge. Now, what the Vedas are saying?
that is not very clear. So there are four schools of philosophy, so six systems of philosophy, which evolved trying to explain what the Vedas say. So for example, there is a book. Now from that book, what is its philosophy? Now philosophy, there may be a philosophical book, but philosophy itself is a body of knowledge. And philosophy involves answering some fundamental questions. Now what is the nature of our identity? What is the nature of this world? What is the purpose of life? There are various questions which comprise the heart of philosophy. So from a book, if you want to understand what its philosophy is, then we have to look at how these questions are answered within that book. And based on that, we will understand the philosophy of the book. So like that, the Vedas are a body of knowledge. And what the philosophy of the Vedas is, that while explaining that, six systems of Indian philosophy, as they're called, Shat Darshan, they emerged. And the most evolved among them, most complete among them, is Vedanta. So Vedanta itself acknowledges that there is oneness between the absolute truth and this world. But what is the nature of that oneness? In that, there is radical division between the Advaitic commentators and the Dvaitic commentators, the Vaishnava commentators and the Advaitic commentators. So the Vaishnava Vedanta says, yes, there is oneness, but within that oneness, there is variety. So here, I will, to understand the import of this verse, especially in terms of contemporary intellectual ethos, let's look at, quickly at what are the broad conceptions of God that are there in various traditions. So now if we look at the major religious traditions in the world are the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And they have the concept of God as other. God is radically different from the world. In fact, he's so different from the world that nothing in this world can be used to depict God. He is utterly other. And that is why within these traditions, any depiction of God is considered a misrepresentation. And that's why any depiction of God should be, they say, destroyed. So now, this idea that God is utterly other, different from the creation, this actually emerged, if we look at the Bible, earlier I talked about a book and its philosophy. So, now, the Bible directly is not a philosophical book. It is basically a book of, the Old Testament is a book of the events that happened in the life of the chosen people. How God intervened at various places. And New Testament is basically a narrative of the life of Jesus and his various parables and instructions that he gave. So neither of them are systematic works of philosophy. So after Jesus came and went, St. Augustine of Hippo, he integrated Christian biblical Bible with the existing philosophy at that time. And that philosophy is the Greek philosophy. So the prominent among the Greek philosophers were Plato. His teacher was Socrates. Socrates did not write anything. So Plato and Aristotle. So Aristotle had a conception of God as what he called the unmoved mover. Unmoved mover. What does that mean? That God has set everything into motion. But after setting everything into motion, he himself is utterly unmoved. And this leads, this idea that God is so completely perfect that he is utterly unchanging. Because why do we change? Now, for example, I am sitting in a particular position. You are sitting in a particular position. Now you shift from this position because you are not comfortable. You want to find a more comfortable position to sit. So usually we desire change because the present condition that we are in is less than perfect. So if God moved because of anything, then that would mean that the earlier situation that God was in was not perfect. And that would make God imperfect. So his idea was, God is the unmoved mover. Of course, this raises the question, if the unmoved state is the perfect state, then why does God need to move anything at all? You know,
why, if the unmoved part is still perfect, why does there have to be a mover part at all? So, but then, if we don't have the mover part, then there is no reason for the existence of the world itself. So, and we know the world exists. So then, therefore, the idea was God is the unmoved mover. Now, from that conception, it was taken into Christianity with some modifications. And that's how they came up with the conception of God as the utter other. That means God is utterly different from us. So, now, the Vedantic understanding is that God and this world are a part of this, of an integrated whole. And the absolute truth, Srila Prabhupada in his introduction to the Bhagavatam, he says the terms God and the absolute truth are not exactly equivalent. Because God is something which it connotes the idea of a controller, the supreme controller, no doubt, but a controller. And some people may believe that there is someone in control, others may believe there is no one in control. So, the notion of God, people may or may not believe in it. But when you talk about absolute truth means that which is the source of everything, that which is the cause of all causes. Now, this is something which is not a matter of belief. Why is it not a matter of belief? Because whatever we exist, it has to have come from somewhere. So even atheists have to acknowledge that everything has come from something. Now, there can be debate on the nature of that something. So whether that nature of that something is the eternal absolute truth, or that something is, as reductionists and atheists would have us believe, a singularity. That is variable. But when we talk about absolute truth, that's not a matter of belief. Everyone has to accept that whatever exists has come from somewhere. Now, what is the nature of that somewhere? That is the question. So, in the Indian systems of philosophy, there are two schools of thought, broadly. They are called as Satkaryavad and Asatkaryavad. Satkaryavad means that the effect is present in the cause. We are now right now discussing, okay, the absolute truth is the source of everything. So then what is the relationship between the absolute truth and the world? That's the subject of discussion. And that's what this verse is exploring. Satkaryavad says that the effect is present in the cause. Whereas Asatkaryavad says that the effect is different from the cause. So to give an example, what this means is that Asatkaryavad, the Buddhism and Jainism, these were actually largely Asatkaryavad. So their idea is that if the effect is already present in the cause, then why do you need to differentiate? Why do you need to say this is the effect and this is the cause? The two could be very, 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 very well called the same. This differentiation comes from a bigger philosophical question, which we could say is the problem of evil. Now God is understood to be good. Now, if God is good, at the same time we see there are a lot of problems in this world. There's a lot of misery in this world. So how is it that from the good God, this world which is filled with illusion and evil comes about? Within the Abrahamic traditions, the problem of evil is narrowed down to a smaller scope. Their scope is that, okay, why does evil happen in this world? Why do sometimes small children get terrible diseases? Why are there earthquakes when suddenly people who are in the middle of life are suddenly cut down? Why are there despotic rulers who are able to tyrannize and kill thousands of people? Why does God allow such evil? This is definitely evil. And this is a question which needs to be answered. But the Vedantic worldview is more encompassing. Rather than look at specific evils in this world, yes, small children getting sickness is evil. It's sad. It's heartbreaking. But then, for that matter, anyone getting sickness is painful. You know, as compared to our nature to look for happiness all the time, the existence of any kind of misery is undesirable. So rather than highlighting specific forms of misery, the Vedantic analysis focuses on the presence of misery itself. If God is good, if God is Anandamay, then why is this world Dukhamay? So to try to answer this question, the point that is made over here is that some philosophers say that whatever is the absolute truth and this world, there is radical disconnect between them. There is no connection there. After an object changes into another object, it produces effect, then they are two different things. And there is no connection. Now the Vedantic scholars, they argue that if the effect were not present in the cause, then any cause could produce any effect. You know, we produce oil from groundnut, but we cannot produce oil from stone. So unless that oil is potentially present in the groundnut, we could not produce oil from it. So if the effect were not present in the cause, then any cause could produce any effect. You know, a woman becomes pregnant. If asatkaryavad would be true, even a man could become pregnant. No, the potentiality for the effect has to be present in the cause. Otherwise, the effect would not come from the cause. So the Vedantic understanding is, yes, everything in this world that is there is present in the absolute truth. And that's why the Vedanta Sutra begins with the first sutra is inquire. And that is the principle of inquiry will come later in this Chatushloki also. But the second is, the definition of the absolute truth is Janma Dhyasyata, that which is the source of everything. And that same thing the Bhagavatam is saying over here. The Lord is speaking that it was I who existed in the past, it is I who am existing now, it is I who will exist in the future. So the later verses of the Bhagavatam will say that the suffering that we experience is because of our sense of separateness from the Lord. And to think of anything as separate from the Lord, that is itself illusion, and that is the cause of misery. That we will discuss later, later. But in this particular verse, Krishna talks in terms of time. And he says that whether it is the past, whether it is the present, or whether it is the future, it is he who is existing all the time. And this means, now obviously, there itself we have Brahma who is existing. Jiva Goswami raises the question in his Chatusutritika, that he says that how is it possible that the Lord can say I alone am existing? Because at that time we can see Brahma is existing, and the Lord is, it is described in the previous verses that when Krishna, the Lord appeared, he was not alone. The goddess of fortune was with him, his associates were there with him. So obviously when he's saying aham eva, I certainly, eva can mean certainly, eva can also mean alone. So I alone, I certainly am existing. So here when Krishna is using the word I, he is using it in an inclusive sense, not an exclusive sense. Exclusive sense means I and you. So you are different from I. But when Krishna is using the word I, he is using it in an inclusive sense to include himself and his energies. Srila Prabhupada writes in the Nectar of Devotion introduction that the absolute truth is Krishna and everything in relationship with Krishna. And he says that Krishna and everything in relationship with Krishna is Krishna. I wonder what does this mean? No, Krishna is one person who has his own individuality, who has his own existence. But Krishna is not just that. Krishna is the absolute truth who manifests as a person, and he is also everything else that exists, because everything else that exists is also his energy that is connected with him. It is not separate from him. So I'll conclude with one rhetorical question which atheists try to argue. Okay, I'll take it in two parts. Sometimes people ask this question, okay, if everything came from God, then where did God come from? So if God created everything, who created God? This question arises from a fundamental misunderstanding of who God is. First, I'll give a provocative example to explain how this question itself is incoherent. It's like if somebody asks you, how can I make a square circle? you can't make a square circle. The question itself is incoherent because square and circle are two different things. And by the very definition of a square cannot be a circle and a circle cannot be a square. So if somebody asks, how can I make a square circle? This question itself indicates one doesn't understand the definition of a circle and of a square. So, if there is a bias for definition itself, a square circle is impossible. And rather than answering this question, one needs to counter the misunderstanding or the ignorance of the definition that has led to this question. Similarly, if someone asks, who created God? And we have to ask, how do you define God? If your conception of God is simply, okay, there's some image in the temple and that is God. Or your conception of God is, okay, there was some person who existed some time ago and that person is God. Well, I'm sorry, your definition of God is wrong. As God is the cause of all causes. This is the definition of God. Then, if we consider this definition of God, then what does this question become? Okay, who created God? Or we could say, who caused God? We use the word cause. Then the question becomes, who caused the cause of all causes? This is itself an incoherent question. It's like, you know, how do you make a square circle? It's basically, if you understand the definition, the question becomes redundant. The question becomes incoherent. So like that, if we understand God, the definition of God is, he's the cause of all causes. Then the question, who caused the cause of all causes, that question itself becomes incoherent. If God had a cause, then the cause of God would be God. So wherever the causal chain will stop, that point is God. Of course, that is not a point, but I'm talking here point in a conceptual sense, not in a philosophical definitional sense. Wherever the cause of all causes stops, that point is God. So therefore, the who caused God, that question itself doesn't make sense. And that question comes because we are looking from an improper frame of reference. It's like a child reads a novel for the first time. And then, okay, there is this character, there is a hero, there is a heroine, there is this villain. And then after reading the whole book and enjoying the book, then the child comes to know, oh, you know, okay, Harry Potter is written by J.K. Rowling. But where is J.K. Rowling in Harry Potter? In Harry Potter's world, there is no J.K. Rowling. Does that mean that J.K. Rowling doesn't exist? No, the novel, the author is not present in the novel. The author created the storyline, the author created the characters, the author created the time frame, but the author exists outside the novel. So similarly, God exists outside the cause effect of this world. So again, when we say God is the cause of all causes, this also sometimes raises to another question. If the soul is eternal, then how did God cause the soul? If the soul is eternal, then is God the creator of the soul? No. If he is not the creator, then how is he the cause of all causes? So here, when we say God is the cause of all causes, we have to understand this is not in a chronological sense. It is in an ontological sense. See, chronology is time sequence. Ontology is the nature of existence. So, when we say God is the cause of all causes, people ask, okay, who caused God? This question, who caused God, comes from the conception that God is also within time. In time sequence, okay, son comes from, Prabhupada quotes the purport, son comes from father, and the father comes from the grandfather, grandfather comes from the great-grandfather. Naturally, when something is within the time sequence, every effect has a cause, and every cause is the effect of some other cause. But this verse, when Krishna is saying, I existed in the past, I existed in the present, I exist in the future. This means the Lord is saying that I exist outside the time domain. And when something exists outside the time domain, applying questions about the time domain to that leads to incoherence. So yes, When you talk about ontology, ontology, I said, is the nature of existence. That means Krishna is the cause of the soul, not in the sense of origination. Krishna is the cause of the soul in terms of sustenance. We would have no existence without Krishna. We are eternal, Krishna is eternal, but our existence is dependent. Krishna's existence is independent. And that's why He is the absolute truth. So, here, when Krishna, when the Lord is asked by Brahmaji, how are you manifesting in a form before me? Your form is transcendental, and how do you manifest in the form? So the Lord is saying over here that actually I am even now transcendent. Although I am manifesting before you, I am not affected by time, I am not affected by matter, I am not affected by anything of this material world. And the same form, the same Lord who is the self-same glory manifested before, He is manifested now, and He will be eternally manifesting hereafter also. Now in the future classes we'll discuss, I'd raise the question of the problem of evil. I just answered it in brief, but I'll address this in future classes. But here, the emphasis of the Bhagavatam is that because Krishna is the absolute truth, in His highest personal manifestation, He is the source of the world, He is the sole reality in this world. At the same time, He is the eternal unchanging reality, despite this world being changing. So in this world, there's creation, there's the phase prior to creation when nothing was there. There is creation when something is there right now. And after creation, nothing will be there. But in spite of that, the absolute truth remains the same. And that absolute truth, when we focus on Him, then the changes of this world do not affect us so much. What I'll discuss in the future classes, I'll further state and I'll summarize and conclude. As I said, everybody accepts there is absolute truth. That in the sense of there is some source from which everything has come. The fundamental difference between the materialistic worldview and the spiritual worldview, the spiritual worldview is from more, less has come. That means Om Purnam, the absolute truth is perfect. And from that, there are some other manifestations that have come. This material world has come. From the infinite absolute truth, the finite living beings have come. So from more, less has come. Whereas the materialistic worldview is from less, more has come. That means originally there was just some unicellular organism. And from that, all the complexity of life has come. And before that, even before that unicellular organism, there was just dead matter existing. So this, we'll see how this notion that from less, more has come, or from more, less has come, that affects radically the way we live in this world. The purpose we ascribe for living in this world, that is radically altered by our sense of where we have come from. That we'll discuss in our future classes. To summarize, here we discussed about in the principle in the Vedic literature that because the message can be quite vast, it is summarized in certain verses which are seen as the essence of a particular book. And this essence is determined both by the content and the context. So I discussed how the Bhagavad Gita Chatushloki falls right in the, just before Arjuna acknowledges that now I have understood Krishna's supreme position. And Krishna also said that I am going to give the most confidential knowledge. And that's the context, and the content is that it is gives the essential principles of Sambandha Videya Prayojan. In the Bhagavatam, in terms of context, the Bhagavatam is basically conversations set in the form of stories, and they are of very important subjects. But within the Bhagavatam from the second canto, around 7th, 8th chapter onwards, the Bhagavatam starts becoming like a biography of the universe, or a history of life within one universe. And within that, our life story is meant to mirror the life story of the first living being, Brahmaji. So from ignorance, he rose to transcendence. His life began with physical and metaphysical darkness, but he went to the level of enlightenment. So how we can traverse that same path, the Bhagavatam guides us towards that. And Brahmaji asks specific questions and the Lord answers. So in this verse, He states that the absolute truth is eternally unchanging. I alone existed in the past, present and future. So we discussed about the difference between the various schools of thought that came in the Veda. So the Vedanta says that yes, this world is related with the absolute truth. But the nature of the relationship is a matter of debate and discussion. In the Abrahamic religions, the absolute truth is considered to be very much other. And that remoteness of God is something which makes God relatively not so lovable, because he can't even be known. Any depiction is considered a concoction, a deviation, meant to be destroyed. And this notion came from the Aristotelian conception of the unmoved mover, that God is himself, he sets the world in motion, but afterwards he's not connected with the world. And we discussed that in the Vedantic understanding, God is connected with the world, and unless the effect is present in the cause, the effect in the cause, effect would not come from the cause. So, in that connection we discuss how, when we say God is the cause of all causes, to say where God came from, it is an incoherent question, which comes from not understanding the definition itself. It's like asking how to make a square circle. So rather than answering the question, we correct the misconception that led to that question. And God is the cause of all causes, not in a chronological sense, but in an ontological sense, because he exists outside chronology. He exists outside time. And from his transcendental existence, where he is eternally unchanging, he manifests within this world and still retains his transcendence. So how his transcendence relates with this world in terms of the ignorance and the misery in this world, that we will discuss in our future classes. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, please. So, at one level, I said that Krishna is a distinct individual. At the same time, everything that emanated from him is also Krishna. So, does this support the idea of people who say that I am God or everything is God, we are all God? No. Firstly, what I said is, Krishna also talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita. In 9.17.18.19, he says, Pitamasya Jagato Mata Dhata Pitama Vedyam Pavitram Omkara Riksama Yajurevacha. He says, I am the grandfather, I am the mother, I am the father. And Prabhupada writes in the purport that the mother is Krishna, the father is Krishna. He says, everything is Krishna. So what does this mean? Krishna says, or rather Krishna says that the person who becomes knowledgeable, Bahunam Janmanamante, Jnanavan Mam Prapadate, Vasudeva Sarvamiti Samatma Sudurlabha. So there is a philosophical difference between Vasudeva Sarvamiti and Sarvam Vasudevaiti. God is everything, but everything is not God. To make this in a more graphic way, difference evident. In the Narasimha Prahlad Leela, At one time, Prahlad is asked by Hiranyakashipu, where is your Vishnu? He says, he's everywhere. Then is he in this pillar? Yes, he's in this pillar also. And then what happens? He knocks down that pillar and Narasimhadev emerges from there. Now, after the whole pastime happens, after Hiranyakashipu is delivered, now Prahlad does not go and garland the pillar. He goes and garland Narasimhadev. Why is that? Although Prahlad himself has said that God is present everywhere, and Prahlad Satyam Vadat, that his words were proved too by the Lord when he manifested through the pillar. And yet Prahlad doesn't go and garland the pillar. He goes and garland Narasimhadev. What that means is that the Lord, that Krishna is everything, in the sense that nothing can exist without Krishna, and Krishna is present in everything. In the 11th canto, I think, 11th chapter, I think 40th verse or 39th 40th verse, Sarvam samapnoshi tatosi sarvaha, it is said. That you pervade everything, in that sense you are everything. Sarvam samapnoshi tatosi sarvaha. So, every Vasudeva sarvamiti, that means Krishna is everything. Nothing exists without Krishna. But that does not mean that everything is a substitute for Krishna. That does not mean everything can be worshipped in place of Krishna. If you see the same verse, Bahunam Janmanam Ante, it says Jnanavan Maam Prapadyate. It doesn't say Jnanavan Sarvam Prapadyate. After many lifetimes, the wise, those who become knowledgeable, they surrender to me, knowing me to be everything. Vasudeva Sarvamiti. Now they know me to be everything, then why does Krishna say they surrender to me? He could have said they surrender to everything. No. So there is a sense of oneness and there is also a sense of difference. That's the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy of Achintya Bheda Bheda. So in the case of the Advaitic idea that when we say everyone is God, there are many implications which are definitely not there in the Vedantic understanding of the absolute truth. The implication is that there is ultimately no need to worship anyone, because the whoever you are worshipping actually, so okay, this is the answer to the philosophical. See, the Advaitavad is actually not so much a contradiction of Vaishnava, of Vaishnava philosophy, as an inversion of Vaishnava philosophy. Inversion means what? The Vaishnava philosophy explains, and that's what the Bhagavatam also says, that the personal manifestation of the absolute truth is the highest manifestation. And from a Brahmanohi Pratishtaham, the impersonal manifestation comes from the Brahman and rests on the Brahman. Whereas the impersonal, the Advaitic idea is that the impersonal is the absolute truth. The impersonal, all-pervasive Brahman is the absolute truth. And Bhagwan, the conception of the personal absolute truth, is a temporary emanation from the impersonal. So when they say that, okay, you know, everyone is God, their idea is that this particular manifestation of God, personal manifestation that you are worshipping, that is an illusion. And ultimately you have to go beyond that and realize the impersonal oneness of all being. So this is a very different conception which is violent to the devotional understanding. Because there is no ultimate reality given to the conception of the personal absolute truth. And their idea is, when you advance, you go beyond the personal and then you realize you are one with the impersonal whole. And therefore, this is very different from the Vaishnava understanding. Vaishnava understanding is that we have individuality, we have personality, we have free will. But our existence is not independent of God's existence. Our existence is based on God's existence. In that sense, because we are His energies, we are eternally dependent on Him, we have no existence independent of Him. In that sense, Vasudeva Sarvamiti. So for another, I'll conclude this point. You know, when Krishna talks about the Vibhuti Yoga, the 10th chapter, He says, Pandavanam Aham Dhananjaya. He says, among the Pandavas, I am Arjuna. Arjuna could say, oh Krishna, we two are one. Then you shut up, I don't have to hear from you. Isn't it, we two are one? If you are enlightened, I am also enlightened. No, when He says, I am Dhananjay, among the Pandavas, I am you. There is a sense of oneness. Vibhuti is of course an elaborate subject, what Vibhuti means. But suffice it to say that it does not imply absolute oneness. So there is oneness, but there is also differentiation within that oneness. And within the differentiation within oneness, there is loving reciprocation. So, Vasudeva Sarvamiti. So, it's not Sarvam Vasudeviti. Of course, we could say that everything is Krishna in the sense that everything is the energy of Krishna. But when the impersonalists say, the Advaitavadis say everyone is God, their idea is that actually there is no need to worship any personal God. So, that is not the Vaishnava understanding at all. Is it clear, the difference? Okay. Any other questions?
Creation. We hear in Bible, there's the explanation of Adam and Eve, and Adam
So, when we look at the Bhagavatam's narration of how creation takes place, the biblical narrative of Adam and Eve being there in Eden, so how do we reconcile that? Is it literal or what? See, the Adam and Eve story, whether it is literal, that is a matter of debate even among Christian theologians. So, there are, because there are several issues with that, because they say that if the immediate criticism of the literal interpretation of the Adam and Eve story is that, now Adam is a person who lived long, long ago, and he committed a sin. And that is also not a very grievous sin. Say it one apple. So now, to say that because of that sin, now everybody is contaminated with evil. All the problems in this world have come because of that one thing alone. So you know, that means all the earthquakes that occur, all the aid that occurs in the world, all the millions of people, they die. They die because someone ate an apple. You know, if it had not been such a grave subject, it would be a laughing matter. So, even from a philosophical point of view, the idea that that one act is the cause of all suffering for everyone, that is philosophically problematic. So, another problem that comes up with the idea is that evil becomes transmitted like a genetic defect. Now, from Adam, he is evil, and through him, because he is the progenitor of everyone, so everyone is evil. So there are Christian theologians also who give theological interpretations of this. And even the 7 days in which God created the world, whether those 7 days literally refer to 7 earth days or they refer to phases within the earth's history or whatever, that is also a matter of debate within Christian theologians. So now first thing we need to recognize is that it's like comparing oranges and apples. If I ask which fruit is better, is orange better or apple better? They're two different fruits. You cannot literally compare them. So, the biblical narrative is coming from a particular frame of reference. It's coming from a particular way of looking at things. And the Bhagavatam narrative is coming from a different frame of reference. And that's why we cannot compare both of them. And the certain principles are definitely true. The principle that when there is suffering, our suffering increases because of rebellion against God. So if we consider Adam's act of eating an apple, not just as an act of eating an apple, but an act of rebelling against God, of wanting to enjoy separate from God, then that makes a broader sense. And then we also see that this is something which is the cause of our suffering. Krishna says in the Bhagavatam, Achitta sarvadurgani mat prasadat tarishati, atachetta mahankara na shoshyasi vinangshyasi. If you act according to my will, you'll be conscious of me, you'll pass over obstacles. If you don't, you'll be lost. So if we look at that more in terms of principles rather than as a literal narrative, then we can make broad philosophical sense of the story. And whether it is literal, as I said, even Christians, they can't explain their own philosophical understanding and the basic problems of life by taking that story only literally. So, that particular kind of... Now, there are some devotees who try to correlate Adam and Eve with one particular Manu called Adam and Havyavati. Now, that sort of correlations are fine, but there is a whole, as I said, a worldview that is associated over there. And just saying that these names are present in the Vedas and those names are also present over there, this name is similar, it glosses over the significant philosophical differences that are there. So that particular incident, because it comes from a different frame of reference, we focus on the principles. We can't analyze from the Bhagavatam's perspective the principle of rebelling against God and that causing our suffering. That is a perfectly compatible principle. The literal narrative is, of course, as I said, it doesn't agree with the Bhagavatam narrative of things. And Jiva Goswami gives the explanation that the Bhagavatam is the Amala Purana. So, what to speak of literature like Bible, even within the Vedic literature, we understand because the Bhagavatam is what is written by Vyasa in the maturity of the revelation. So, the Bhagavatam is the highest Pramana, And whatever other things are given in the other literature, in the other Puranas also, to the extent they agree with the Bhagavatam, to that extent we say that they are telling the truth. To the extent that they are not agreeing with the Bhagavatam, that means it is a relative truth given for a particular purpose. Just like we have certain scriptures which may talk about Sahitanada Devata as supreme. That is for people with a particular mentality to offer them limited elevation. So, Krishna's mercy, there is always the frame of reference for understanding the absolute truth. Without considering the frame of reference, we will not be able to understand what the absolute truth is. And the frame of reference is so important that once we understand the frame of reference, we will also understand the absolute truth does not always speak the absolute truth. What does that mean? In Govardhan Leela, Krishna speaks Karma Mimamsa. Krishna says, actually, why do you need to worship the devatas? So you can simply, you just do your duty. And the devatas will give, they are duty bound to give the results. This is not the Vaishnava philosophy at all. Why is Krishna speaking this? No, Krishna is playing with Indra's ego over here. He's telling Indra, you are irrelevant. He is inflaming Indra's ego. So the Acharyas explain, and this is not just Acharya's interpretation, they're not imposing their words on Krishna's words. Krishna himself speaks other things at other places. So the point is, even when Krishna speaks something himself, there may be a particular context in which he is speaking it. And in that, if we understand that context, then we will understand that this may not be the absolute truth all the time. So we have to understand the Siddhanta from the Shastra and then see everything in the light of that Siddhanta. Whether be it within the Bhagavatam itself, within the broad Vedic literature, or within scriptures outside the Vedic literature also. Does that answer your question? Any other questions? One last question. Yes.
You talked about the soul being eternal. So, in that case, how can we say the soul is, I mean, Krishna is a positive soul, if the eternal.
Okay. So, if the soul is eternal, then how is Krishna the cause of the soul? Yeah, the word cause has multiple meanings. So, for example, if a child builds a house of cards, so the child is the cause of the house of cards. So now the child is the cause of the house. The child is not the cause of the cards. The cards are already existing. The child made the house. So here we are using the word cause not in the sense of origination. We are using the word cause in the sense of arrangement. Or organization rather. So the child organized the cards into a house. So the word cause itself can have various meanings in that sense. It's not necessary when something is the cause of something, that doesn't necessarily mean that it alone is the source of that. So for example, if we say this caused that to happen, his words made me angry. Okay, that the words may be a cause of my anger, but it also may be that I might have been in a bad mood because of something, and because of that, the words sparked my anger more. So there is within causes also there are various kinds of causes. So here, when we talk about Krishna being the cause of all causes, and Krishna being the cause of the soul, here the word cause is used in the sense of the nature of something, nature of the existence of something. It's not its source. That means the soul and Krishna both are eternal, but the soul is a dependent truth. The soul cannot exist without Krishna. Natadasti vinayatsyan maya bhutam characharam yachapi sarvabhutanam vijam tadaham arjuna. That Krishna says that nothing can exist without me. I am the source of everything and nothing can exist without me. So, to understand this notion of, this understanding of God, again going to the Prahlad Maharaj pastime, now before Narasimhadeva appears, Hiranyakashipu asks Prahlad, who is the source of your strength? Even the devatas, they tremble when I raise my eyebrows. But you are so audacious. Who is the source of your strength? Now here, Hiranyakashipu has the conception that maybe there is some being and he is giving strength through Prahlad. And he is thinking that if I can crush that being, then Prahlad's bravado will also collapse. So now Prahlad's answer is actually from a completely different frame of reference. What does he say? He says the absolute truth is the source of my strength, your strength, and even Brahma's strength. He is the source of all living beings. So what he is saying, what Hiranyakashipu is saying is, he is thinking of God as just one being among many beings. Maybe he says Vishnu is the best of all beings, but I can become better than him. That's his idea. See, when some people have the idea that God is the best of all beings, you know, okay, there is a hierarchy of beings and God is the best. Now this is at one level true, but it is not a complete understanding of God. Because if we say God is simply the best of all beings, then okay, you may have in tennis, so and so is the best player. Well, tomorrow somebody else can become the best player. Isn't it? If we simply think of God as the best of all beings, then we may think God is replaceable. Somebody else can become the best of all beings. So God is not just the best of all beings. He is the basis of all being. He is the basis of all being. Nothing can exist without God. And Prahlad's answer is from that frame of reference. He is saying, you are thinking, okay, there is some being who is superior to you and you will try to overpower him. No, that being, he's the source of my strength, your strength, Brahma's strength, everyone's strength. So God exists as the foundation of all being. So what it means here is that Prahlad is saying in Hiranyakashipu, even you will not have any strength without him. So like that, the soul will have no existence without God. In that sense, the soul is caused by God. It is more in the sense of the nature of existence, not the source of existence. Does that answer your question? Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Granthra Shrimad Bhagavatam ki, Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki, Gaur Premanande.